Crises are a part of everyday life for ops. It doesn't take long to confirm that Shannon's hypothesis is correct. It was a problem in the order entry backend system. All the systems in that particular cluster are pegged at 100% CPU usage. Unfortunately, the system being hit is part of the main ERP, which handles almost all the core financials of the company. It's been running for over 30 years, but it's stuck on a version that is almost 15 years old. It's been so customized that it's been impossible to upgrade. At least it's put on newer hardware every 5 years. But there's no easy way to throw more CPU cores at it to speed it up. Apparently, even the small 1% promotion is causing it to get backed up. Maxine sees that queries are taking longer and longer to return, and client requests start timing out. All those clients start resending their queries, causing even more requests to overload the back-end database. "Thundering herd problem," Wes mutters, referring to when simultaneous client retries end up killing a server. "We can't do anything on the back end. How do we get all the clients to back off on the retries? We can't change the mobile apps, but we can get the e-commerce servers to wait longer before they retry," Brent says. Wes points at Brent and Maxine and says, "Do it." Maxine and Brent work with the e-commerce teams to push out new configuration files to every web server. They are able to push out all these changes into production in less than 10 minutes. Luckily, this is enough to stave off disaster. Maxine watches in relief as the database error rates start decreasing and the number of completed orders starts creeping up again. Several other things go wrong over the next 2 hours, but none of them are as heart-stopping as the available-to-promise server issue that she and Brent had to deal with. Another 45 minutes later, they cross over their goal of 3,000 completed orders, grossing $250,000 in revenue, and the orders are still coming in strong. Maggie must have snuck out, because 2 hours later, Maxine sees her come back into the room with a bunch of people carrying champagne bottles. Maggie opens one up and starts pouring glasses, handing the first to Maxine. After everyone has a glass in hand, Maggie raises hers with a big smile. "Holy cow, everyone. What a day. And what an amazing team effort. I want to share with you some of the early results, and wow, they are great. People are continuing to respond to the promotions, but at this point, almost a third of the people responded to our campaign. This is, without a doubt, the highest conversion rate we've ever achieved by at least a factor of 5. She pulls out her phone and peers at the screen. Here are some early calculations from our team. Over 20% of people who received our offer went to view the products we recommended, and over 6% purchased. We've never seen any numbers like this. So thank you to everyone here who helped make this happen. And remember, almost all the items we promoted are high-margin items or were sitting on shelves gathering dust. So each sale we made today will have an unusually large effect on profits." Maggie cheers and drains her glass. Everyone laughs and follows suit. She says, "Based on these results, the unicorn promotion campaign to our entire customer base on Black Friday is a go. If the results are anywhere near what we saw in this test campaign, we are going to have a blowout holiday season." Just a reminder, this is insider information. If you use this information to trade parts on limited stock, you can go to prison. Dick Landry, our CFO, told me to tell you that he will assist in your prosecution as per your employment contract, she says, and then smiles. But having said that, there's no doubt we're going to crush it on Black Friday. Everyone cheers loudly again, including Maxine. Maggie motions for everyone to quiet down and asks Kurt and Maxine to speak. Maxine laughs, motioning Kurt to go. He says, "What an amazing effort, everyone. I'm so proud. Maxine?" Maxine hadn't wanted to say anything, but being cornered like this, she stands up and raises her glass. "Here's to the rebellion showing the ancient, powerful order how kick-ass engineering work is done." Again, everyone cheers and laughs. When that all dies down, Maxine says, "Okay, enough of that. On Black Friday, we can safely expect 100 times the load as today. We'll surely run into tons of problems we've never encountered before, so we've got our work cut out for us between now and then. Let's figure out how to best prepare for it." Kurt adds, "I'd like to send as many people home on time tomorrow as possible, given that it's Thanksgiving on Thursday. So let's get to work." And we'll need people in the office early on Friday to support the launch. They agree to stagger the emails and mobile app notifications to prevent the systems from being slammed all at once and to better protect those unexpectedly delicate back-end servers. Brent comes up with an idea to reconfigure the load balancers to rate limit the transactions. This will cause customer errors on the mobile app and e-commerce servers, but everyone agrees this is far better than those back-end systems crashing again. We'll get on it. I think we'll be in good shape and get everyone out of here in time for Thanksgiving, Brent says with a big smile. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone! As Brent predicted, all the work is done before 5 the next day. With just a couple of exceptions, people start heading out. Maxine is making the rounds, trying to shoo the stragglers home. It's the day before Thanksgiving, and Maxine wants to get out of here by 5:30. She's proud that she even got Brent to leave. One team that couldn't leave were the data analysts. Now that the 1% test proved to be a smashing success, they had to finish generating all their recommendations for millions of customers by Friday. The resulting compute loads on Panther keep growing, and they keep updating the promotions data in the Narwhal data platform. Maxine thinks with a grin, we're racking up a heck of a bill with the cloud computing providers, but absolutely no one in marketing is complaining because the business benefits are so spectacular. She swings in to say goodbye to Kurt, but freezes mid-stride when she sees Sarah having a heated discussion with him. And I walk around this building after 5, and there's barely anyone here. Kurt, I don't know if you realize this, but the company is on the verge of extinction. We need everyone pulling their weight, Sarah says, fuming in righteous indignation. I think we need some mandatory overtime. Buy them more pizza, and they'll be happy to stay and do the work. And if that weren't bad enough, she continues, I just saw a bunch of people sitting around reading books. We don't pay people to read books. We pay them to do work. That should be pretty clear, right, Kurt? Kurt's expression remains deadpan. You'll have to bring that up with Chris. Banning books from the workplace is above my pay grade. She gives him a dirty look and storms out. Kurt makes a motion to Maxine, indicating that he wants to hang himself. It's so strange, he says. She thinks we pay developers just to type, instead of paying them to think and achieve business outcomes, and that means we pay them to learn, because that's how we win. Can you imagine banning books from the workplace? He says, laughing and shaking his head. Maxine just stares at Kurt. Sarah's beliefs are like the antithesis of the third ideal of improvement of daily work and the fourth ideal of psychological safety. Maxine knows that the only way they could have achieved what they had was by creating a culture where people felt safe to experiment, to learn and make mistakes, and where people make time for discovery, innovation, and learning. No argument from me, Kurt. Let me know if you convince her, Maxine says, smiling, waving goodbye. Happy Thanksgiving. Maxine has a fantastic Thanksgiving. It's the first since her father died, and she enjoys having everyone over, even if she is surreptitiously looking at her phone all the time to see how the Black Friday preparations are going. The highlight of Thanksgiving is when Waffles, now not so little, tipping the scale at 40 pounds, grabs a big piece of turkey off the table in front of everyone, to Maxine's horror. It was the first time he had ever done that, Jake promises everyone. Everyone pitches in to clean up after, and Maxine goes to bed early. She needs to be in the office early the next morning. At 3:30 a.m., she's in the office with the rest of the team. The technical teams had been going through their launch checklist, getting ready for the surge in demand that would start in a couple of hours. They grab another conference room for the extended teams who can't fit in the first. It's a larger affair than the 1% test they ran on Tuesday. Each conference room has a similar configuration of big U-shaped tables with about 30 people seated. She starts her day in the room where the technical teams are assembled. In the extended war room are the Narwhal and Orca teams next to the monitoring team. The web front-end teams, the mobile teams, and the numerous back-end service teams responsible for products, pricing, ordering, and fulfillment. There are many more technical teams on standby in the chat room. All of these services have to run seamlessly for products to be presented to a customer and for orders to be placed. On the huge TV monitor on the wall are more technical graphs showing the number of visits to the website, stats on the top product pages, as well as health checks and most recent errors from all the services represented in the room. In the primary war room, they've set up a second TV where some of these technical metrics are displayed. And today, they have more representatives from business and technology leadership the entire Unicorn and promotions team, and even people from finance and accounting. Everyone who matters is here to see how the campaign goes. At 4:30 a.m., Maxine is hanging out with Kurt and Maggie in the primary war room. She is looking for something to help with, but everyone seems to know what they're doing. At this point, all she can do is get in the way. They are 30 minutes away from the beginning of the campaign launch. Sarah is here too. As far as Maxine can tell, she appears to be haranguing someone about the pricing and promotional copy for one of the offers. Maggie is also in the huddle, not looking happy, saying, "Look, I know we want the offers to be perfect, but the time to make changes was yesterday. The risk of making changes in the copy is just too high for something going out to so many people. It might delay the launch by another hour." "This may be good enough for you, but it's certainly not good enough for me. Get this fixed, now," Sarah says, eliminating any further discussion. Maggie sighs and walks away, rejoining Kurt and Maxine. "We're going to have to make some changes," she says, rolling her eyes. "Undoubtedly, this is going to push back the launch by at least an hour." "I'll go tell the technical teams next door," Kurt says, grimacing as he leaves the room. An hour later, things are again finally ready to go. Maggie asks the front of the room, "If there are no objections, let's launch at 6 a.m. That's 15 minutes from now." When the launch begins, Maxine is in the business war room, watching the large TV monitor like everyone else. Within 2 minutes, over 10,000 people have hit the website and are going through the order funnel, and the rates of arrivals keep climbing. And again, all the CPU loads start climbing, much higher than in the test launch. People clap as the number of completed orders passes 500. Maxine is amazed at the scale of customers who are being mobilized by this launch. She holds her breath, hoping that all their hard work hardening their systems will make this launch boring. She watches as the number of orders continues to climb, until they flatline, just like on Tuesday. Damn it, Maxine mutters. Something is definitely going wrong again, and in the same portion of the order funnel. Something is preventing people from the shopping cart checkout. Wes hollers, "Someone tell me what's going on with the shopping cart. Who has any relevant data or error messages?" Shannon is the first to speak up again. Maxine marvels at Shannon's uncanny ability to be the first on scene. "Web shopping cart is generating an error. Fulfillment options aren't being shown. I'm guessing some fulfillment service is failing. Posting screenshot in the chat room." Someone from the other side of the room hollers, "iOS mobile app crashing again." Wes swears. The mobile app dev manager swears. Suddenly, Maxine tunes everything out, because in that moment, she's suddenly afraid that maybe Data Hub is causing the problem. She's still trying to think this through when she hears someone from the mobile team holler out, "Wes, the app just crashed after I hit the checkout button, right when it should have presented all the transaction details. I think a call to a back-end service is timing out. I thought we fixed all the places where that can happen, but we obviously missed one. We're trying to figure out which service call is causing the problem." "Could that be a call to Data Hub?" Maxine whispers to Tom. "Not sure," Tom says, thinking. "I don't think there's any direct calls from the mobile app to us." On her laptop, Maxine pulls up the logs from the production Data Hub service, looking for anything unusual, grateful that she can do this herself now. She sees a couple of incoming order events, which generate 4 outgoing calls to other business systems. They all appear to be succeeding. Seeing nothing, she turns her attention back to the front of the noisy room, where Wes, Kurt, and Chris are convening. Seeing that they're actively in discussion, Maxine joins them. She hears Wes ask, "So what service is failing?" Chris and Kurt powwow for a bit, and Wes apparently loses patience. He turns to the entire room and hollers over all commotion. "Listen up, everyone. Something in the transaction path between bringing up the shopping cart and completing an order is failing. Maxine, what are the names of each of these transactions and service calls?" Although she is surprised at being prompted, she quickly rattles off 11 API calls and services off the top of her head. Brent calls out 3 more. "Thank you, Maxine and Brent," Wes says. Turning to the room, he hollers, "Okay, everyone, prove to me that each one of those services are working." Minutes later, they discover the problem. When a customer views the shopping cart, they are presented with the order details, payment options, and shipping options. When all that is correct, the customer hits the place order button. Apparently, when displaying this page in the mobile app and on the web, a call is made to a back-end service to determine which shipping options are available based on their location, such as next-day air and ground shipment, as well as providers such as UPS and FedEx. This service calls out to a bunch of external APIs from the shipping providers, and some of those are failing. Brent suspects that they are all being rate limited by one of them, because they'd never had Parts Unlimited servers send so many queries like this before. Maxine can't believe that a service that seems so trivial is jeopardizing the entire launch. She smiles and makes a note of this, because she knows that this will likely be the new normal. But for something this mission critical, there's no way we should depend on external services, she thinks. We need to gracefully handle the case when they're down or when they cut us off. Maxine joins the technology team leaders huddling in the front of the room. She suggests, when we get shipping API failures, maybe we present just the ground shipment option. We know that this type of shipping is always available. Thoughts? The fulfillment service team lead nods, and they quickly work through the details with Wes and Maggie. They decide that, effective immediately, if they can't get information from all shippers, they'll just present ground shipment as the only option. After all, it's better to take their order and ship it slowly, as opposed to giving them an error page. The team lead says, give us 10 or 15 minutes to push the code change out. I'll keep you posted. And runs from the room. 10 minutes later, Maxine is pacing, waiting for the fulfillment team to announce that they're pushing their fix into production. When that happens, everyone will high-five each other and celebrate. She's still waiting when someone yells out, Wes, web server page requests are timing out and front-end servers are crashing. These aren't 404 errors. Two servers are actually rebooting and clients are starting to get unable to connect errors. Maxine looks at the dashboards and is shocked at what she sees. The entire web server farm is pegged at 100% CPU utilization, with some of them X'd out because they have hard crashed. Page load times have gone from 700 milliseconds to over 20 seconds, which is basically forever, and still climbing. This means some people going to their web page won't see anything at all because the requests for the page are not being fulfilled. Wes is staring at the graphs too, and then attempts to load the web page on his phone. Confirmed. Nothing is loading in my mobile browser. Web server team, what's going on? He hollers out. They're in the next room, Kurt says. I'll go find out. Maxine follows. In the next 10 minutes, they learn just how bad the problem is. A record number of people are hitting the e-commerce site. They had anticipated this, which is why Brent had blasted their site with a homemade bot army, making sure they could actually handle such a heavy load. But apparently, they missed something important. They hadn't tested for real customers coming to their site, who were presented product recommendations based on their customer profile. This was a new component they had created in the last week. The component wouldn't render for bots, only for actual customers who were logged in. As real customers hit their sites, this component made a bunch of database lookups from the front-end servers, which were never tested at this scale. Now those front-end servers are crashing under the load like a house of cards. I need ideas on how to keep those front-end servers alive. I don't care how crazy, Wes says from the front of the room. The enormity of the problem is clear to everyone. 70% of all incoming traffic is through the web. The largest portion of their order funnel is still the web. And if that stays down, all Black Friday goals will go down with it. Get more servers into rotation? Someone says. Wes responds immediately. Do it! No, Brent, not you. You stay here. Get someone assigned to it. Other ideas, people? More ideas come out, and almost all of them are shot down. Brent says, the recommendation component is what's causing the unusual server load. Can we disable it until traffic dies down? Maxine groans inwardly. They had worked so hard to get it working. And now they might have to tear it out to keep the site running. Interesting. Well, can we or can't we? Wes says, asking the room. A group of managers and technical leads huddle with Maxine and Brent, and they quickly brainstorm ideas. They finally decide to just change the HTML page, commenting out the recommendations component. A brute force approach that Maxine appreciates because no code changes are needed. The front-end team lead says, We can change the HTML page and push it out to all the servers within 10 minutes. Go, Wes says. Maxine watches over the shoulders of two engineers as they carefully modify the HTML file. They're careful because a mistake in the HTML can break the website as thoroughly as any code change. When he's done, they review it together, commit the change into version control, and initiate the push into production. They're surprised when there is no impact to the front-end performance, even after 3 minutes. They keep waiting to see a change, but servers keep dying. "What's going on? What did we miss?" the engineer says, obviously trying to stay calm. Confirming over and over that his modified HTML file is being loaded in the browser. "I can see your changes in the HTML served by the site," Maxine announces loudly. "There must be another path that displays the recommendations component." Wes is watching from behind them. "Everyone, the new HTML file has been pushed into production, but we're still getting excessive CPU load. I need confirmation that recommendation component is still getting rendered somewhere. Give me hypotheses and ideas." It takes 4 more minutes for them to discover that there is one more place where the component can be rendered. Maxine watches as they push another HTML file and is relieved to see that 60 seconds later, the CPU load drops by 30%. "Congratulations, team," Wes says, pausing to smile. He continues, "But that's not enough to keep our servers up. What else can we do to reduce the load, people?" More ideas are proposed. More ideas are shot down. But some are jumped on immediately. The server load finally dips another 50% when the most common graphic images are offloaded from their local web servers and moved to a content distribution network, CDN. This takes almost an hour to fully execute, but it's enough to prevent the site from going down entirely. And so it goes for the rest of the day. Hundreds of things going wrong, some big, some small, and never just one problem at a time. Like in their postmortems, they learn how imperfectly they understand this incredibly vast and complex system they've created, and now must keep operating under extreme conditions. Hours fly by. There are moments of tired smiles and high fives, as heroic acts keep everything running. The number of completed orders continues to climb, and Maxine is relieved that incoming order rates peak around 3 p.m., giving people a reason to hope that the worst might be behind them. Strangely, Maxine has a brief glimpse of Sarah looking sour on the sidelines, but even this doesn't bother her. Maxine's so proud of how well her teams did, handling every crisis that was thrown their way quickly, adapting and learning. And absolutely everyone knows that all this adversity is a great thing, because it is a consequence of the outrageous success of the Black Friday promotion made possible by the Unicorn Project. By 4, it's clear that the worst is behind them. Order traffic is still incredibly high, but off 50% from their peak earlier in the day. The number of failures and near misses are down to a less bewildering rate, and people are actually starting to relax. As evidence of this, Wes is now wearing a Parts Unlimited baseball hat with a unicorn and large flames emblazoned on the side. He is laughing and joking with the people around him, handing out hats to everybody who walks by. Shortly before 5, Maggie goes to the front of the room, and the champagne bottles and plastic cups are carried in by her staff. When everyone has a cup, she says, "What a day, everyone. We made it." Everyone cheers, and Maxine drains her glass. She's exhausted, but she can't wait to hear the business results from everything they've done today. "This is the largest digital campaign that this company has ever done," Maggie says. "We sent more emails today than ever. We pushed out more mobile app notifications than ever. We had the highest response rates, the highest conversion rates. We had higher e-commerce sales today than any other day in the company's history. We will likely have the highest margin on sales today than any single other day. How's that for the Unicorn Project pulling through?" Maxine laughs uproariously and cheers loudly, along with everyone around her. Maggie continues, "It's going to take days to get final numbers, but you can see on the screen behind me that we've booked over $29 million in revenue today alone. We blew away last year's sales record by a mile." Maggie looks around the room for a moment, cheers again, and then says slowly, "This is a watershed moment for Parts Unlimited. This is what we've been reaching for years. This shows that even horses can do unicorn-like things. Trust me, this will turn a lot of heads, and our job now is to start dreaming bigger. We've shown what an incredible business and technology team working together can do, and we've got to elevate the dreams, goals, and aspirations of our business leadership. Bigger and better things are yet to come, everyone," she says. "But in the meantime, we've all earned the right to celebrate. That is, when Wes says it's safe for us to celebrate. Kurt and Maxine, get on up here and say a couple of words. Kurt joins Maggie, laughing as he beckons to Maxine to join him at the front of the room. Here's to a kick-ass technology team that supported the promotions team. We took a bunch of risks, and we did things that had never been done before in this company. As Maggie just said, we have a chance to make a material difference to the performance of the company. Kurt turns to Maxine, obviously expecting her to say something. Maxine looks at everyone for a moment. I'm so proud to be a part of this effort. Kurt is right in that we all took a bunch of risks to get here. And I think we've all learned so much in this journey. I can't believe how much we've gotten done since I was first exiled to the Phoenix Project only a couple of months ago. Working on the Unicorn Project has been one of the most rewarding and fun things I've ever done, and I've never been as proud as I am today. And I can't wait to celebrate with all of you tonight, because I heard that Kurt is buying drinks at the dockside. But there is one thing I need to say, she says, waiting for people's cheering to quiet down. As awesome and amazing as what we pulled off today was, we're a long way from being done. We're basically Blockbuster, who just figured out how to do paper coupon promotions. If you think that's enough to save Parts Unlimited, you must be smoking something. Maggie's right. We're just at the beginning of our real fight. We haven't blown up the Death Star yet, not by a long shot. It's still out there. What we did today was we finally figured out how to fly our X-Wings. Our world is still in grave danger, she continues. But we finally have the tools, the culture, the technical excellence, and the leadership to win the fight. I can't wait for the next chapter to prove that we're not a Blockbuster or Borders, Toys R Us, or Sears. We're in it to win it, not to be another casualty of the retail apocalypse. Having said what she wanted to say, Maxine looks up and sees the shocked looks on everyone's faces. Oops, Maxine thinks, realizing that maybe she should have saved that speech for a private conversation at the dockside. Then she hears Maggie say, Holy cow, Maxine is so right. I'm totally going to use that line with Steve and Sarah. I can't wait for round two. Everyone laughs, and then people start applauding and cheering, Maggie loudest of them all. Although at the mention of Sarah, Maxine looks around puzzled. She's nowhere in sight. This is a very bad sign, Maxine thinks. Usually she'd beat her to claim credit, or pounce on someone if something went badly wrong. But Maxine is feeling too exhilarated to really care. Kurt and Maxine are the first ones at the dockside. They push a bunch of tables together and pre-order a bunch of pitchers of beer for the large group that will be assembling there soon. Kurt looks squarely at Maxine. By the way, this is a great time for me to tell you how much I appreciate everything you've done. We couldn't have done this without you. The rebellion changed when you arrived on the scene. Hearing this, Maxine smiles. You're welcome, Kurt. We make a great team, and I'm so grateful that you sucked me into all of this. She sits down as people start to file in and takes a sip of her wine, thoroughly enjoying it. She discovered a couple of weeks ago that Eric had instructed the bartender to always serve her from a special stash of wine from a vineyard owned by a friend of his. She looked into buying a bunch of bottles, but balked when she found out how much it cost. Apparently, Eric drastically subsidizes the cost for her here. She bought one bottle for her and her husband to drink on a special occasion. As if he knew she was thinking about the wine, Eric arrives, grabbing the seat next to her. Congratulations to you both. You did terrific today. Now you need to show Steve and Dick how the future requires creating a dynamic, learning organization where experimentation and learning are part of everyone's daily work. It's funny, when Steve was VP of manufacturing, he was very proud that hundreds of plant workers' suggestions were put into production to improve safety, to reduce toil, to increase quality, and to increase flow. That, too, is also a form of continual experimentation. You now need it at a much larger level, liberated from the tyranny of product management and functional silos. The fifth ideal is about a ruthless customer focus, where you are truly striving for what is best for them, instead of the more parochial goals that they don't care about. Whether it's your internal plans of record, or how your functional silos are measured, he says. Instead, we ask whether our daily actions truly improve the lives of our customer, create value for them, and whether they'd pay for it. And if they don't, maybe we shouldn't be doing it at all. Eric gets up, and one of the bartenders arrives with a newly opened bottle of wine. Eric takes it and places it in front of Maxine with a wink. Congratulations, Maxine. Catch y'all later tonight. He leaves just as six more of their teammates walk through the door. Maggie turns to Maxine and Kurt and asks, "What was that all about?" "I'm trying to figure that out myself," Maxine says, "but it's nothing that can't wait until next week. Maybe we can find a moment to talk later tonight. But in the meantime, let's celebrate." The next morning, when Maxine wakes up, her head is pounding. On top of the dockside celebration, she and her husband had a couple more drinks while watching their favorite TV series late into the night. She didn't actually remember falling asleep. Such was her sudden exhaustion. She wants to go back to sleep on this Saturday morning, but she scans her phone. There is some chatter in the chat rooms about an ongoing issue in the stores. Apparently, store managers are having problems because of overwhelming demand for promoted items. They were completely out of stock, and it was taking them 15 minutes per customer to create rain check orders, having to key each one into another clunky in-house ordering system. The in-store app teams were dispatched to the stores to figure out how to speed things up. Someone thinks they could write a simple tablet app to simplify the process. Maxine likes the idea, and she has full confidence that they'll come up with a fix that will delight the in-store managers and staff. She smiles, satisfied that this problem could be solved without her. Over the past month, she has grown to trust and respect her teammates and appreciate what they're doing. Maxine grins as she looks at the tickets to Comic-Con that Jake bought yesterday for her and the whole family. She smells bacon and eggs. Jake must be making breakfast, she thinks. Maybe she can go back to sleep after eating. Life keeps getting better. Chapter 16. Friday, December 5th. 1 week later, Maxine is sitting in the fanciest conference room she's ever seen. She's in Building 2, where all the top executives have their offices. The building is nearly 70 years old, one of the oldest and tallest on the corporate campus, complete with wood-paneled walls. For Maxine, it's surreal to look at who's sitting at the table. Never before has she been in a meeting with so many top executives. At the head of the table are Steve, Dick, Sarah, and three other executives she doesn't recognize. This is the first time that she's been in the same room with Steve and Dick outside of the town halls. Maxine is surprised that Eric is sitting at the table too. Steve and Dick don't give him much notice, as if they're used to having him around. While Maggie is at the front of the room getting ready to present, Maxine stares around the room, representing the opulence of a bygone era. She feels like she needs to tell Kurt not to touch any of the paintings or steal any of the fancy things hanging on the walls. It's like the bridge crew decided to invite the red shirts from engineering into the captain's quarters for tea, asking for their advice on how to deploy their starship fleet. Which is, it occurs to her, what's actually happening. Maggie's briefing the top company executives on the blindingly awesome success of the Unicorn Project, the looming remaining threats that Maxine had warned about, and to present their proposals. When Steve nods, Maggie begins her presentation, reviewing the amazing Black Friday statistics. Even though Maxine has seen her present before, she's still blown away by Maggie. She's on fire, brilliantly describing what the team did and the amazing business outcomes they generated. All that activity resulted in what you've seen in these official revenue numbers. Because of the Black Friday campaign, we posted nearly $35 million of revenue on top of our run rate business. Almost all of those orders came in through the web or our mobile apps, she says. For a variety of reasons, we believe this is mostly additive revenue. In other words, revenue that wouldn't have been attained were it not for these campaigns, which was the result of thousands of experiments analyzing our customer base in ways we've never been able to before. This was made possible by the five incredible technology platforms we created and using all the data in our systems to make fantastic predictions on which promotions would most effectively drive sales. We moved inventory that had been sitting on shelves, often for a year or more, freeing up badly needed working capital, she says. Looking forward, assuming we can generate some equally exciting promotions over the holidays, I'm thinking we could be looking at $70 million of upside revenue. That's 20% above what we've been signaling to analysts and Wall Street. That generates smiles and a buzz of conversation, especially from Dick. That would lift our net margins to levels we haven't seen in 4 years, Steve, he says. It's been way too long since we've actually surprised analysts in a good way, that is. There's laughter around the table, and Steve has a happy but tight-lipped smile on his face. People are in a good mood, Maxine sees, except Sarah, who is scowling, periodically taking out her phone and tapping furiously to someone. Maxine stares at Steve and Sarah, mystified at the strange dynamics between them. Maggie continues, There's more good news. We've put a huge amount of focus on improving the in-store systems to better help store managers incorporate the practices that we know every one of our rockstar store managers use. We've put a bunch of new capabilities into the tablets that employees use, making it easy for them to do things like look up the availability of parts and ship them from other stores. Maybe more importantly, in every tablet app, we took out any question that slowed down the ability for our in-store employees to help our customers, she says. We used to ask them for the customer name or phone number first, with no way to skip. No wonder our employees stopped using those tablets. In the last 60 days, in-store sales for our pilot stores are up almost 7%, Maggie explains. To put this into perspective, the non-pilot stores have had flat or negative same-store sales. This performance is extremely noteworthy and shows that better customer service enables more sales, which has always been a Parts Unlimited core value. Like most businesses these days, we use the Net Promoter Score to rate customer satisfaction. We ask our customers on a scale of 0 to 10 how likely it is that they would recommend our stores to their friends. The 9s and 10s are promoters, the 7s and 8s are neutrals, and the rest are detractors. To compute the scores, we subtract the percentage of detractors from the percentage of promoters. An NPS score of 30 is considered good, and above 50 is great. For nearly a decade, we've hovered around 15, which puts us right in the middle of the pack among our competitors. But that's also what most airlines get. So it's really not something we brag about, she says. We did a little experiment after the Black Friday promotion. We compared people who bought a promoted item versus the population at large. Customers who bought something during our promotion swung 11 points higher than the rest. And when you look at the pilot stores with ship-to-store and the new in-store apps, they swing almost 15 points higher. I've never seen anything like this in my career, she says. Those stores are now scoring higher than any of our competition. They're now on par with some fantastic retailers, like IKEA. For a store that sells windshield wiper fluid, I think that's pretty amazing. She moves on to the next slide. Our store managers are also reporting improvements in employee engagement and morale. Here's a quote from one store manager that I keep reading over and over again. My in-store staff love the new in-store systems. One of my staff actually cried. She said that the old system not only made her feel stupid and helpless, but also frustrated because she couldn't help our customers. Thank you so much to you and your team for making a real difference to my team and our customers. Maxine hears impressed murmurs all around the table. Steve smiles broadly. It's been true for hundreds of years and probably thousands more. Employee engagement and customer satisfaction are the only things that matter. And if we do that right and manage cash effectively, every other financial target will take care of itself. Maxine can't help herself. She says to Dick, As a numbers person, do you really believe what Steve said? That's quite a bold claim, isn't it? Dick smiles, as if he really appreciates the question. I do believe it, especially as a numbers guy. Some of the most revered and admired companies all had that in their heyday, like Xerox, P&G, Walmart, Motorola. Now it's Toyota, Tesla, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon. How you achieve those metrics have changed, but the importance of those metrics are still the same. Amen to that, Dick, Eric says. Well done, Maggie, Kurt, and Maxine. It's so exciting to see happen, and I really think we're moving the needle, Maggie says, smiling almost as broadly as Maxine is. I've saved the best for last. 6 months ago, we had one of the worst mobile apps in our industry. I'm guessing that all of you have installed the app, but none of you have spent more than a couple of minutes in it. Maggie smiles, looking around the room at the sheepish grins around the table. She says, Don't feel too bad, because I hadn't either. Everyone knew that this was a real problem. If we can't create a compelling reason to use the app, if we don't solve an actual problem that our customers care about, why did we even build it in the first place? We've spent a lot of time studying our customers, trying to figure out their wants and needs, she says. So we made a couple of bets, looking at what we could build that would keep customers coming back for more. Here's one bet we made. She advances to the next slide, showing a picture of a VIN sticker that is on every car manufactured since 1954. Typing in these VIN numbers is the bane of almost every Parts Unlimited employee, she says, resulting in knowing chuckles from around the room. All of you have worked in store. You know how difficult and error-prone this is. We now enable customers to use their app to create a profile for all of their cars. They just scan the VIN on their car using their phone camera, and we automatically populate the information of the car. Make, model, year, and we can even pull records in from Carfax and other services. Now they can walk into a store, and our in-store employees can scan a QR code on their phone to pull up their customer's record. Our employees don't need to walk out to the customer's car, sometimes in the rain and snow, to write down that 14-digit VIN on a piece of paper. One of our store managers said, "This is a game changer." Besides being great for our customers, it's great for our employees. For the first time, it's like we're doctors who have their patients' charts on hand. We know our customers' history, what's important to them, and we can better help keep their cars on the road. I've been told thank you more times in the last month than I have in most years. This could create some exciting business opportunities. We could potentially create all sorts of maintenance programs for them. We could explore subscription programs where they automatically receive parts based on their consumption. We could potentially partner with service stations to get any needed work scheduled, or even do it ourselves, she says, advancing to the next slide. To me, the success of all these programs suggests that there are some opportunities that could dramatically reshape the future of Parts Unlimited, she says, looking more serious than she has during the entire briefing. After the Black Friday promotion, Maxine said that we were still a long way from winning the war. Just like a better coupon campaign wouldn't have saved Blockbuster, we are still a long way from figuring out how to survive the digital disruption or retail apocalypse. As good as the quarter may turn out, we haven't blown up the Death Star. It's still out there, and we need to figure out how to engage it in battle and win. Otherwise, we risk decline, irrelevance, or worse, extinction. Maxine feels herself blushing, but keeps her attention on the executives. She knows Maggie is starting her pitch. Project Unicorn could just be the beginning of learning how we can dominate the market by understanding our customers better than anyone else does, she says. After all, we created this market almost a century ago. Our proposal is that we fund more teams to explore the most promising business ideas, to find the next winner like the Unicorn Project. What I've learned in promotions is that it's an extremely experimental process, an exercise of exploration and learning. Not every idea is a winner, she says. For every winning idea, there are many losing ideas. And some of the winners seemed outright crazy and never would have been approved by the typical middle manager or committee. The literature suggests that, in general, only one out of every three strategic ideas has a positive result, and only a third actually move the needle in a material way. And that's for the big strategic ideas, she says. For feature promotions, A/B tests, or algorithmic testing, you may be thrilled to even have 5% of tests work. We need a group that is dedicated and empowered to explore a broad range of business ideas that take advantage of our unique position in the marketplace, to quickly make bets and then explore and validate them, she says. We need to have some way to quickly shut down bets that don't pan out and to double down on the winners. Project Unicorn shows that we have the capability to do this, she says. But this time around, we need to do it with the sponsorship and support of the highest levels of organization. Maxine sees Steve smile, looking not just interested, but delighted. He applauds loudly, but before he can say anything, Eric speaks up. "Miss Lee is exactly right, Steve," Eric says, looking up from his notebook, which appears to be full of doodles. You are in charge of a century-old business that might finally be climbing out of its doldrums, thanks to the heroic work of Maggie, Kurt, and Maxine. Everything around you has been built upon the success of your Horizon One, or cash cow business. And as Maggie is alluding, you have nothing in Horizons 2 or 3. Maxine looks around and confirms that she's not the only person confused by what Eric just said. Steve doesn't appear to be fazed by Eric's non sequitur. Instead, he asks, "What are Horizons 1, 2, and 3, and why are they important?" "A great question," Eric says, standing. "The concepts of Horizons 1, 2, and 3 were popularized by Sensei Dr. Jeffrey Moore, who is most famous for his book, Crossing the Chasm, which introduced the customer adoption curve into modern business planning. He observed that customer adoption is a Gaussian distribution curve, naming them the innovators, early adopters, early majority, late majority, and laggards. And yet, as brilliant as this was, I think he will be best known for the four zones, which help us better organize ourselves to win in all three horizons. Horizon 1 is your successful cash cow businesses, where the customer, business, and operational models are well known and predictable. For you, that's your manufacturing and retail operations, which make up 60 and 40% of revenue, respectively. Both of these businesses generate over $1 billion in annual revenue, but are under fierce attack by competitors and disruptors," he says. "Almost all businesses fade over time because any profitable operation will attract competitors. The economic logic of selling reductions in transactional cost is irresistible and inevitable," he says, "which is why Horizon 2 lines of business are so important, because they represent the future of the company. They may introduce the company's capabilities to new customers, adjacent markets, or with different business models. These endeavors may not be profitable, but this is where we find higher growth areas. It is from here that enterprising leaders create the next generation of Horizon 1 businesses. For you, this transition happens when your Horizon 2 business revenue hits $100 million. You may have guessed that Horizon 2 efforts come from Horizon 3, where the focus is on velocity of learning and having a broad pool of ideas to explore," he says. "Here, the name of the game is to prototype ideas and to answer as quickly as possible the three questions of market risk, technical risk, and business model risk. Does the idea solve a real customer need? Is it technically feasible? And is there a financially feasible engine of growth? If the answer is no to any of them, it's time to pivot or kill the idea. If the answer is yes, then the idea is continually developed until it earns the right to graduate to Horizon 2, where the business builders take over," he says, pausing for a moment. "Your obvious problem is that you have virtually no Horizon 2 businesses and absolutely no Horizon 3. Steve, your intuition serves you well. You know you need to explore Horizon 3 opportunities, and you know how different Horizon 1 and 3 are," he says. "Horizon 1 thrives on process and consistency, on rules and compliance, and on bureaucracies, which create extraordinary resilience. These are the mechanisms that allow greatness to be consistently delivered over decades. In contrast, in Horizon 3, you must go fast, you must be constantly experimenting, and you must be allowed to break all the rules and processes governing Horizon 1," he continues. "As Maggie says, it's about fast iteration, making lots of bets and doubling down on the winners until they graduate to become Horizon 2 businesses. This is where the new methods are forged and mastered, which will likely help the organization survive into the next century. And in this age, and nowhere more than in Horizon 3, speed matters," he says. "In the pharmaceutical business, the effort required to create a market offering is huge. Billions of dollars are spent over a decade to create a new drug. The instant you have an idea, you patent it, which gives you only 20 years of IP protection before generic copies are allowed and your ability to charge a price premium disappears." There, Sensei Dr. Steven Spear observed that for each day you can get to market faster, you can often capture upwards of millions of dollars of additional revenue. If you're first to market, you will capture 50% of the revenue that the entire product category will ever yield. Second place will capture 25%, and third place will get 15%. For any later entrants, it will surely have been a complete waste of time and money. Speed matters, or more precisely, lead time from idea to market offering matters," he says. "And regardless of what horizon you're in, this is the age of software. Almost all business investment now involves software, and that means we must elevate developer productivity, as Maxine has so splendidly done. Eric looks at his watch and starts gathering his things. I will leave you with one last caution. Horizon 1 and Horizon 3 are often in conflict with each other. He gestures at Sarah meaningfully. Left unchecked, Horizon 1 leaders will consume all the resources of the company. They will note correctly that they are the lifeblood of the company. But that's only true in the short term. There is an instinct to maximize profitability and take cash out of the business instead of reinvesting it. This is the manage-to-value thesis, and is the opposite of manage-to-growth. If you want growth, Steve, you must protect Horizons 2 and 3, and any learnings generated there must be spread throughout the company. Eric looks to Maxine. You saw how all the learnings from Data Hub and the Unicorn Project made it possible to achieve the original goals of the Phoenix Project. There are plenty more learnings to be had. And, in fact, I suspect creating a learning organization will become front and center soon. Eric looks back at Steve. You created one of the safest and most admired manufacturing organizations in the world by creating a unique learning culture where physical safety is embraced by everyone in the organization, he says. What if psychological safety is as much of a precondition to dynamic learning organizations as physical safety? He looks at his watch again. I've got to run, folks, he says, heading to the door. I have a lunch date that I can't miss. I wish you the best of luck. The survival of the company surely depends on it. Everyone stares as Eric leaves the room, pulling his suitcase behind him. Maxine looks back at Steve, who looks thoughtful. With some awe, she remembers Eric suggesting that she must enlist Steve's help to change the culture of fear of the technology organization. I can't believe he teed that up for me, she thinks. Maxine is trying to think of what she must do when Sarah stands up. She says, Steve, as much as I appreciate what Maggie and her little team have done, I think this is a losing proposition. Your chairman and boss, Bob Strauss, has grave doubts about the future of the company, Sarah says. We cannot drive up R&D expenses for any wild-eyed ventures, these so-called Horizon 3 activities. We have demonstrated over and over that we simply do not have the DNA to compete against all the startups on the low end, and we cannot continue to fight a two-front battle on the manufacturing and retailing side on the high end at the same time. Our two Horizon 1 businesses are struggling. At this point, Bob's idea of splitting up the company and selling off the pieces is our only prayer of salvaging shareholder value. Absolutely no one is interested in buying them together, she says. During our preparation for the January board meeting, Bob and our new board director, Alan, have convinced me that the growth path is just too risky. In fact, I'm convinced we should do another round of headcount reductions immediately to shore up profits. This is the right thing to do for our shareholders, and it will undoubtedly make us more attractive to acquirers when we start the roadshow with the investment bankers, she continues. This is what I'll be recommending in my meeting with Bob and Alan in our special board subcommittee. Sarah gathers her things with an expression that Maxine can only characterize as sinister, she says to Steve. I noticed that you were not invited to that meeting. Too bad. I'll let you know how that meeting goes and what we decide. Maxine watches with everyone else as she opens the door and exits, wondering why Steve can't just fire Sarah. Why does he put up with her antics? The excitement and pride she was feeling moments ago is gone. Could Sarah really disregard everything that the Unicorn Project had achieved? Was it all for nothing? She thinks back to when everyone was celebrating after the successful Black Friday launch, except Sarah, who had mysteriously disappeared. Watching the door close, Maxine realizes that her worst fears about Sarah dismissing or undermining their efforts aren't so crazy after all. Steve stares at the door for several moments before he lets out a long sigh. He turns to the rest of the room. Unlike Sarah, my bets are on the growth thesis. If we're not growing, we're shrinking, and that's not why I'm here at Parts Unlimited. There's no question that we need to make Horizon 3 bets. Dick and I have already modeled this scenario. I propose carving out $5 million to fund Maggie's innovation efforts, he says. Maxine's heart leaps, realizing that Maggie's proposal may still have a chance. Then Steve says, but Sarah may be able to cut us off at the knees if she convinces Bob to cut staff and expenses. Maybe Bob and the rest of the board won't be that short-sighted, Dick replies. At Steve's skeptical expression, he says, Well, if it happens, we'll figure something out. In the meantime, what would we do with that $5 million? How do we put it to work? Over the next 3 exciting hours, an outline of a plan emerges. Kurt, Maggie, and Maxine will be part of the innovation team, reporting directly to Bill Palmer. Kurt and Maggie will be 2 in a box, occupying the same position in the org chart, sharing responsibility for the business and technical outcomes. You will be responsible for nurturing new promising ideas and exploring market risk, technical risk, and business model risk, Steve continues to summarize. Each initiative will have clearly defined business outcome measures, such as customer acquisition, repeat customer usage, or customer satisfaction. At the end of each quarter, we'll review progress on each initiative, and we'll make a decision: continue funding the project, kill it, reassigning the team to the next best idea, double down on the project, or graduate it to Horizon 2. We'll also decide whether the entire program needs to be grown or shrunk. Your charter is to find new ways to use technology to better enable supporting the nearly century-old vision. Help our customers keep their cars running so they can conduct their daily lives. Steve turns to Bill and says, To capture the best ideas, go create an innovation council. Find 50 of the most respected people from across the entire organization, including store managers, sales managers, technicians, engineers, and of course, the technology organization. Bill nods, taking notes on his clipboard. Maxine sees everyone around the table nodding in agreement. As they adjourn, Steve says to everyone, I have the utmost confidence in Bill, who will be leading this effort. This is something that we've never done before, so it will be new to almost everyone. So let us know what we can do to support you and your effort. Roger that, Bill says, gesturing at his clipboard. He says, I already have a list of things I'd like your help on. As Bill rattles them off, Steve quickly mobilizes resources from across the entire company. Maxine marvels at how efficiently Bill gets what he needs from Steve and the resources Steve is putting at Bill's disposal. After the meeting, Bill asks Kurt, Maggie, and Maxine to walk with him back to Building 5. The entire walk back, Maxine hears Kurt and Maggie share how elated they are at how the meeting went. Maxine is excited to be working with Bill, who has always seemed level-headed and a straight shooter, and he's already demonstrated how effectively he can drive large initiatives. To Maxine, it seems like Rebellion victory is within sight, with all the sponsorship, funding, support, and energy they need to win. But there's still the question of Sarah. If she succeeds in convincing Bob Strauss to break up and sell the company, then the evil empire will have won. But not even Sarah can pull that off. Right? Chapter 17, Friday, December 12th.
What do you mean we're losing all our people? Kurt says, looking shocked.
It's 1 week after the meeting with Steve and Dick, and Maxine has been pleased with how the agreed-upon plan is rapidly progressing. Bill, Maggie, and Kurt are starting to put together the Innovation Council, and work within the Unicorn Project is going faster than ever, preparing for the massive Christmas holiday promotion launch. The Orga team continues to study the data from the Thanksgiving campaign, and they are certain they'll have an even higher response rate this time around by incorporating what they've learned. All their experiments and results are again being poured back into the Panther data platform. They are also continuing to harden the infrastructure to handle the resulting onslaught. However, many of the things they took for granted after last Friday's exciting meeting with Steve and Dick no longer seem certain, which is why Chris summoned Kurt and Maxine to his office. They were never your people, Kurt. You were temporarily loaned out a bunch of engineers for the Unicorn Project, says Chris. All those engineers were already assigned to other projects in the new fiscal year, which starts in a few weeks. They're all important business projects with people depending on them being fully staffed. All those business managers are raising hell because we've reassigned those resources, and they've banded together in revolt.
But why now? Kurt asks, incredulous. What got everyone so riled up?
Chris laughs humorlessly. Sarah's stirring the pot, egging them all on. Bill is pulling together another meeting with Steve and Dick to figure out how to deal with the shenanigans she's pulling.
I can't believe Sarah is stirring up a counter-rebellion to, counter our rebellion. Kurt mutters, sounding offended that Sarah had stolen his playbook. Later in the day, Bill writes, "Continue as planned. We'll figure out how to backfill those positions. We are stuck in the middle of a huge political battle. Sarah and a board faction are on one side, and we're on the other side with Steve and Dick." Throughout the day, they discover that Sarah is indeed an incredibly effective corporate guerrilla fighter, having successfully raised an insurgency army against them over the past week. Maxine is grudgingly impressed with her resourcefulness, despite driving her batshit crazy. She wants nothing more than for Sarah to just give up and go away. "In so many ways, Sarah is a remarkable person," she tells her husband at dinner. "In a slightly different universe, Sarah could have been an amazing force for good. If this were a superhero movie, she'd be the gifted person who turns into the villain after some traumatic life event, and now she goes out of her way to crush all sparks of joy she can find." Monday morning, Kurt and Maggie meet with Bill to stave off Sarah's efforts to undermine them. Maxine stays behind, resuming her work with Cranky Dave on a technical issue jeopardizing both the Unicorn Promotions campaign and the Core Phoenix application. Over the last month, they had started building tons of automated tests for Phoenix so that they could better and more safely make changes. The effort was incredibly successful. However, with so many tests, running them now takes hours, and developers are starting to avoid checking in their changes, not wanting to wait for the long test times. Worse, some of the automated tests were failing intermittently. Last week, she cringed watching as a developer, whose test failed, just ran them again, and they also failed. So he ran it a third time, as if it were a slot machine in a casino. This time it passed. "This is no way to run a development shop," Maxine thought with embarrassment and distaste. Recognizing that this will soon become a new bottleneck for developers, she had the teams work on parallelizing the Phoenix tests so they could be run across multiple servers. But they discovered that running parallel tests caused Phoenix to occasionally deadlock or crash entirely. And if it's crashing during testing, it's probably crashing in production too. "Maxine, we've narrowed it down to an uncaught exception somewhere in the Phoenix order fulfillment module," says Cranky Dave. Maxine is with Cranky Dave and another engineer with laptops open.